years before the skies had darkened with missiles and the civilized world disappeared forever, American scientists were working on different aspects of a top-secret program under the umbrella name of the Totality Concept. The aspect that affected the life of Doc Tanner was a part of Over Project Whisper, called the Cerberus Project. The hidden gateways, Matrans chambers, were in closely guarded fortresses or redoubts, which were scattered across North America. But they didn't just transport a man in a flicker of frozen time from place to place. The scientists believe they could also be used to breach the last barrier, time. And in that misguided belief, they experimented in trawling a human being from the past. The failures were many and horrifying. The one partial success was Doc Tanner. Married with two young children, Doc had been a respected man of science in the year of our Lord, 1896. Ryan's reminiscence was checked as Doc wiped a gnarled hand over his chin, bringing it away smeared with blood. November 200 years ago, the young scientist had been tugged forward through time to become the prize guinea pig in Project Cerberus. But Doc had never been the sort of person to sit quietly. After a number of combative years, he became so troublesome that the faceless man had a choice. Terminate him or cron jump him again. So Doc had been flung 100 years into the future. A few weeks later, all of the scientists he had left behind perished in the rad blasts of the last world war. Ryan had known him for about a year. Now Doc's mind was reasonably reliable, but the shattering events of his life had permanently tipped the balance of his brain, and he was known to wander mentally. Lori Quint, his girlfriend, for lack of a better word, lay stretched out on the floor next to him, her blonde head in his lap. Some of his blood had dribbled into her long hair, clotting and tangling. Though she was only 17 years old, Lori had endured an appalling background of incest and violence. Her affection for the elderly scientist had been obvious, but over the past few weeks, Ryan had begun to notice signs that all wasn't well between them. The girl was becoming easily irritated and sulky. But Ryan had learned from his old friend and boss the traitor a great and inalienable truth about women.
What women want from men is what men happen to be right out of.
Sitting cross-legged next to Doc and Lori was the only person of the group other than Ryan who'd ridden and fought with Trader. Now shaking his head to clear the clinging fog in his brain, J.B. Dix, the armorer, was recovering consciousness. Under 5'9" in height, slim built, J.B. was closing in on his 40th year. His complexion was sallow and unhealthy, and his wire-rimmed glasses were hooked safely in a top pocket of his dark brown leather jacket. His beloved and much-traveled fedora lay between his feet. The armorer was perhaps the greatest expert on weaponry in all the Deathlands. His preference was for a mini-Uzi and a Steyr-Aug pistol. A Tecna fighting knife at his hip completed the obvious fighting gear, but his clothes and combat boots also concealed a wealth of hidden equipment. Fuses, picklocks and stilettos, wire and a little Plasex, as well as a folding sextant. JB was a walking arsenal. As Ryan looked across the chamber at his oldest friend, the man's gray eyes flicked open. He glanced around at the others.
Doc got a bloody nose. Rest look okay to me.
Yeah, right.
There were two other people in the Matran's room, both of them still unconscious. Next to JB in the circle was the youngest member of the traveling group of companions, a lad about 15 years of age. He weighed 110 pounds soaking wet and was 5'4" tall. His long mane of spun silver hair cascaded across his skinny shoulders like a winter fall of Sierra meltwater. His mind blanked by the jump, the boy looked like a sleeping child, at peace with the world. To Ryan's knowledge, Jack Lorne had killed upward of 100 human beings and probably as many muties. When it came to close-quarter butchery, Ryan had never seen anyone to match the teenager. A satin-finished 357 Magnum was tucked in his belt. The torn leather and canvas jacket he held in his lap, in camouflage brown, gray, and green, had tiny shards of razored steel sewn into it. He also carried several, Ryan never knew how many, leaf-bladed throwing knives. The youngster's ruby-red eyes remained stubbornly closed, though movement of his fingers showed that Jack was coming around. Christy Roth leaned against the armorglass wall close by Ryan, still in the classic lotus position, the palms of her hands flat upon her thighs. Her fiery crimson hair was bunched protectively around her neck. Christy's body trembled, and she sighed. Then she opened her dazzling green eyes, turned her head, and half smiled across at Ryan.
Oh. Don't get any easier, do they, lover?
No, they don't. Just wish we could learn how to control where we go on these jumps. I worry that one day we're going to end up in a gateway that doesn't exist, with half a mountain on top of us.
Reminds me of the time back in Harmonyville when I was a girl. Fat guy named Johannes fell clean up the top of a 200-foot Ponderosa. Folks heard him all the way down yelling out, "So far, so good! So far, so good!" Know what I mean?
Ryan had heard the story before, but it still amused him. Each time Christy told it, there was a different location and a different person doing the falling, but it remained a good tale. Now everyone was coming out of it. Lori rolled on her side, her face a pale yellow, holding her stomach.
Ugh, I feel sick.
She raised a hand to investigate her hair.
Ugh, blood! Who's bleeding? Doc? All going in my buggered hair?
She managed to get to her hands and knees before beginning to retch. It had been some time since their last meal, and there was nothing in her stomach but threads of golden bile.
By the three Kennedys, what's amiss here? Small nasal hemorrhage, I do believe.
Jack Lauren tried to stand up, steadying himself against the shimmering gray wall.
Ah, head fucked. Hate jumps. Oh, head feels bad.
Take it easy, Jack.
Lori had stopped retching and had also stood up, picking at the matted blood in her hair. Ryan slowly uncoiled, picking up the Heckler & Koch G12 automatic rifle from the floor, then checked that his 6-hour 9mm pistol was safely holstered at his belt. He reached down to help Christy to her feet, getting a smile of appreciation in return. JB stood up in his neat, effortless way, brushing dust off his clothes.
I don't think I'll ever enjoy these jumps.
Doc was last to his feet, dabbing at his bloodied nose with a blue swallow's eye kerchief. He leaned on his ornate ebony sword stick, gripping it by the silver lion's head top.
Upon my soul, but I have made a dreadful mess on the floor. Considerable tapping of the claret.
And on my head, you stoop crazy! Got it on my boots!
Sorry, my dearest dove.
Doc moved to put his arm around her, but the tall blonde moved away, shrugging pettishly.
Everyone ready?
Wonder where we are now. Can't smell or taste nothing. Know when we get outside.
JB glanced across at Ryan.
Now?
Yeah. Blaster's ready, people. Christy, you open the chamber door.
The trigger of the caseless G12 felt good with Ryan's index finger wrapped around it. True, they'd never yet encountered a gateway where the main control room had been infiltrated, but there had to be a first time for everything. Christy brushed the tumbling hair away from her face, gripped the handle, and pushed the armored door open.
Safe.
As was usual in the gateways, the main mat trans chamber opened into a small anteroom, which was only about 12 feet square and contained no furniture. A row of shelves lined one wall, and a dark green plastic beaker stood